In our 24th message in the exposition of Acts, we're going to cover Acts chapter 12, except for the last phrase, the entire chapter, and speak about the folly of fighting God. Now remember, Acts is not a day-to-day history that's going to be chronologically correct or involve things that are, you know, this happened, then this, and then the next. But Acts 11 ends with Paul and Barnabas taking charity to the famine victims in Jerusalem. That's AD 46. It's in the history books. That's when it happened. No question of the date. Acts chapter 12 happens in AD 44, 2 years earlier. And so it's, like I say, it's not orderly in that regard, but it is in that it is the final episode of God dealing with the Jewish Christians, the Jerusalem Christians, the believers that were in that area, as opposed to reaching out to the Gentiles, which begins in Acts chapter 13 and through the rest of the book. And so it makes sense that Luke is just pulling a couple of vignettes out from a few years earlier to talk about what God was doing. You see, ever since Pentecost, there's been a series of successes. Okay, a few negatives, minor details like Stephen being stoned and things like that, but it was this one saved and 3,000 saved and then 5,000 saved, and then the apostles are arrested and released from prison. And then there's trouble in the church, and God strikes Ananias and Sapphira dead. And the church goes out to Cornelius and the Samaritans and the Ethiopian eunuch and Antioch. And it's just exciting. This is kind of the end of that era. But in Acts chapter 12, in this last little section, the rivalry between God and Satan becomes very clear. Now, I love rivalry. You know, I'm a football fan. And today, the Minnesota Vikings are at the Green Bay Packers.
Wasting electrons again.
I'm a fan. I'm scared. I make my picks. Well, they're already made. And last week, of all the games, I only missed one. And that's because one game ended up in a tie. I could have had a perfect score if the stupid... Rivalries. We have rivalries. Some of you love Mac, and some love PCs. I love Big Mac, but that's another story all in itself. Some are Chevy versus Ford people. There's a rivalry of Democrats and Republicans, of Spider-Man and Venom, or the rivalry that my kids had, which was my children versus vegetables. A terrible conflict, terrible rivalry that went on there like that. But the kingdom of light and the kingdom of darkness are in conflict in chapter 12. Boy, it's finishing up this whole section on the Jewish Christians, and it is focusing on this, and yet it speaks of how foolish we are to fight against God. Whether we win or lose, we win. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, you know, they're not going to bow down, we'll throw you in the fiery furnace. And they said, our God's able to deliver us. Next sentence. And he will deliver us. In the third sentence. But if he doesn't, we're still going to worship him. And I thought, that's the kind of attitude we have to have. So, let's look at the power struggle here in this rivalry. First of all, the power of evil. The power of evil men. We begin with the martyrdom of James in Acts chapter 12, verse 1. For about that time, King Herod Agrippa I laid violent hands on some who were members of the church. Now, there's lots of Herods. Herod the Great. Think of the birth of Jesus, kill all the babies, that's grandpa. Then his son Herod, another Herod, Herod Antipas, is the one at the trial of Jesus. Now his grandson is King Herod Agrippa the First. He was appointed king of Palestine by Gaius in 37. The next emperor, Claudius, who he went to school with in Rome, said, oh, we'll not only give you Judea and Palestine, we'll give you Samaria and Galilee and all of that. And so he is a politician. And politicians like to take shots at weak people. It makes them look strong and powerful. Some have said recently, I'll take away the guns of everyone in America. Well, you know, what is that? That's not necessarily the wisest thing to get elected on, but that's what people are saying. Here, the anti-Christian, anti-Bible, anti-morality guy is Herod Agrippa. It pleased his citizens who didn't like Christians. They didn't believe the Bible, the morality there. And so, about that time, and again, there's no chronology here, it's somewhere in that four-year reign from 41 to 44, he says, okay, I'll arrest Christians. This sounds like a really good move politically. Verse 2, he beheaded James, the brother of John. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, the fishermen, they all worked together in Galilee, all disciples. That's this James. He arrested him and beheaded him. It shattered the illusion that the 12 disciples were under some divine protection and that the special intimates of Jesus, you know, Peter, James, and John were the ones. I gave a number of references in Matthew, in the Gospels, or Matthew, Mark, and Luke, of how they would go with Jesus and to pray, and they would do certain things. They were on the Mount of Transfiguration. These were the inner circle. These were the big names. And James and John had come in Mark chapter 10 to Jesus and asked to be considered the two chief lieutenants. Of all the disciples, we want to be the chief. And Jesus said, you can't drink the cup that I'm going to drink. And James says, oh yes, we can. And Jesus said, oh yes, you will. And as Jesus was crucified, James was beheaded. Clement of Alexandria, the disciple of John, James's brother, records a story that the person guarding James to bring him out to be beheaded. Now think about this. He's going to lay his head down on a block and have a sword cut his head off. And the person guarding him wept. And they said, why do you cry? And he said, because I believe like he does. And so after James was beheaded, his guard was beheaded because he claimed to be a Christian. There's no replacement here. This isn't like it was when Judas the traitor had to be replaced. Now it was, the 12 disciples are going to die eventually. And they do. But they also know that in Revelation they will be restored in the resurrection to leadership roles in the church. So, power of evil. Kill James, one of the disciples. When Herod, verse 3, when Herod saw how much this pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter during the days of unleavened bread. I'd have to wait a day to kill Peter until after the Passover was over. But, you know, this is great. It's kind of like Herod looked at the crowd and they took a poll and they showed increasing popularity. And this is great. We can make our nation great again by just killing these Christians. Kill James? Hey, tomorrow we'll kill Peter. It's the Feast of Passover. The city's crowded with Jewish people. And Peter is the apostle who took the gospel to the Gentiles, to Cornelius, to Samaria. So if any Christian is hated more than any other Christian, it's Peter. So, hey, tomorrow we'll get him. That's what you say, arrested him. They said, this is great. It's a grandstanding to the crowd. And he arrested Peter, not for religious motivations. He didn't care. He was political. He's gaining points. He's going ahead in the polls. Verses 4 to the beginning of 5. When he had seized him, he put him in prison and delivered him to 4 squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after Passover to bring him out to the people. So Peter was guarded in prison. Now we're going to catch the other part of verse 5 where the people are praying in a couple minutes here, so just hang with this. Why such a high security detail? 4 squads of soldiers to guard one preacher. Well, you might remember back in Acts chapter 5 that Peter was in prison and an angel came and let him out of prison. All the apostles were there. Herod's no dummy. He knew what had happened. So he says, I got this good. I can do this. 4 men, 6-hour shifts in the Antonio Fortress, which has one wall against the temple enclosure. So it's in overlooks and looks down on the temple and the courtyard there. He said, we got him in the prison. We got him as safe as it can be. We've got 4 soldiers, 1 chain to one arm, 1 chain to another, and 2 of them in front of the only door into that cell. After 6 hours, we bring another squad in. 4 units of soldiers to protect him and watch over him, because Peter was a victim. Or was he a victim? That's the power of evil. Kill, arrest, intimidate. I'm sure the believers were scared to death. I'm sure that they all were wondering, am I going to be next? Will the next knock on my door be Herod's police to come and arrest me? Skip ahead now to verse 6. Finish verse 5 later. Verse 6 of Acts 12. On the very night before Herod was to execute him, Peter was sleeping between 2 soldiers, bound with 2 chains, sentries in front of the doors guarding the prison. Behold, an angel of the Lord stood near him, and a light shone in the cell. He whacked Peter on the side and woke him, saying, get up quickly. And the chains fell off his hands. I like Acts because this is storytelling. I'm a grandpa. Hello. I love to tell stories. You don't have to make this up. This is what happened. No signs of anxiety. Oh, Peter, you're going to get killed tomorrow. And Peter says, well, that's God's will. Fine. At least I'll die with a good night's rest. And he's sound asleep. A day after his best friend and co-worker, James, had been beheaded. No insomnia here. By the way, we have some references in your notes because Peter seemed to be real apt at being able to sleep. When Jesus said, stay here and watch, he slept. Jesus said, pray, he slept. Peter was a good sleeper. That's one of the spiritual gifts that many Christians have. Even in churches during the pastor's sermon. So, well, you know, and what did the psalmist say? He gives his beloved sleep. So, Peter is, you know, poked with a sharp stick. I don't know what exactly happened. Strobe lights go off. Bright lights. Chains fall off. The guard on each side, sound asleep. Guard in front of the doors, sound asleep. And a miracle happens, and the biggest issue is trying to wake Peter up. But Peter had had a vision. Remember, Peter had visions before? He was probably thinking, okay, this is a dream. This is a vision. I'll wait for a sheet to come down, and maybe dinner will be on it. And now that had happened a couple chapters earlier. The angel said to him, verse 8, dress yourself, put on your sandals, and he did so. Then he told him, wrap your cloak around you and follow me. It's sort of like the angel is a parent on the first day of school. Okay? After a whole summer of sleeping in, doing what you want, whatever, then the first day of school comes, and some children wake up an hour early. They're so excited they can hardly stand it. They eat, you know, 15 Pop-Tarts so they have enough sugar to help their teacher all day. Most children are, oh, no, do I have to get up? Which, my wife used to do this with our children. It started when they were little, and it was for Sunday, the only day they had to get up. But then it started school days, and then when our youngest got into school, she became a teacher again and started to have to be up, and they all had a time. She would have them make neat piles. Neat piles. She would say, okay, when you wake up, you go to the bathroom, you brush your teeth, you wash your face, what's the first thing you're going to do then? Well, I'm going to put on my underwear. Then I'm going to put on my shirt or my dress or whatever. Then I'm going to put on my socks. Then I'm going to put on my shoes. Then I'm going to go out and find out what's for breakfast. So she had them make piles. The shoes were at the bottom. The socks were next to the bottom. The pants or the dress were next to that. In other words, so that the child didn't have to open their eyes if they didn't want to. And that's what the angel's doing. He said, put on your shoes, Peter. Put on your coat. Wrap it up tight. It's nighttime. It's cold out. Wrap yourself up. And like a parent on the first day of school, Peter needed this coaching. And he just kept looking for that sail to come down with breakfast in it. I don't know what he did like that. The power of God. Amazing. And it wasn't just in the cell. Look what happened as he's delivered in verse 9. Peter went out and followed him, this angelic person. He didn't know what was being done by the angel was real. Thought it might be another vision. When they passed the first and then the second guards, they came to the iron gate that leads to the city, and it opened, and the Greek word is automaton. It automatically opened. You know, this is really cool. You know, it's like, I love those buttons at every store now. They have these big things that I can whack with the end of my cane, and the door opens. It's like magic. Really cool. And so, Peter comes there, and the door opened automatically. They went out, they went down a block, and then the angel left. You see, God's in control. There's no worry about what man plans. Hey, Peter, you're going to get killed in the morning. Probably beheaded like James. But God was doing something without explanation, saying, it's not time for you to die. Your time will come, and it did. But until then, I've got work for you to do. Now, why was James killed, and then 2 days later, Peter was rescued? Let me share the answer. We don't know. I'm just saying. We don't. You say, well, Peter had all this more. Well, Peter was going to serve God until God said it's time. He was invulnerable till God said, all right, now it's time. Peter lived. James died. Was James a loser? Ask him in heaven. Oh, I'm in heaven with the Lord forever. And not on earth having to put up with Peter or whatever James is thinking there. You know, we think death is losing. Peter is out here and goes, wow, this is amazing. Matter of fact, that's exactly what he said in verse 11 as this part of the story closes. When Peter came to himself, doesn't say he slapped himself on the cheek, he pinched himself, whatever, he said, now I'm certain the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and all that the Jewish people were expecting, which was, of course, another death. Jews believed in guardian angels, but Jews all expected Peter to die. Matter of fact, you know what? The Christians all expected Peter to die, too. James had been arrested, head cut off. Peter's arrested, day after Passover is coming. Hey, Peter, he's chopped meat, but you know what I mean. Your head's going to get cut off, too. You're dead. Sundar Singh in Tibet was a Christian who was likewise freed from prison. He was thrown down into a dry well, a cistern, cover put over it, a lock on it, tight there for preaching, to be brought out in 3 days and executed. Or, as the judge said, or just maybe left in there. And he was dropped down in there, broke his leg and arm in the being thrown down. And in there were all these bones of other prisoners who'd been thrown down in there and just left to rot and die. After 3 days, he heard noise at the top of the cistern, saw the cover was slid off to the side, and a rope dropped down with a loop at the end of it. And a voice said, put your leg in the loop, which is good because he had a broken leg. He couldn't climb or do anything, but he put his leg in there. And he was pulled up to the top. The figure pulled the cover back over, locked it again. And when Sundar looked to thank this man and find out what was happening, he wasn't going to be killed. He wasn't going to be executed. The man was gone. And he thought, maybe like Peter, I've seen an angel. And maybe that happened. I don't know. He didn't go into hiding. He went back to the same place where he'd been arrested for preaching and started preaching, telling everybody that God had released him so he could give the good news that you need to be born again. Well, he was arrested as soon as daylight came, brought before the same judge, and the judge was upset and angry. Said, I got to get to the bottom of this. He said, there's only one key to unlock that cistern like that. I'm going to find out who stole that key and unlocked it and let him out. And Sundar looked at the judge, and the key was hanging on its belt, still sitting there on the judge's belt. I believe in miracles. I'm not going to put God in a box and say, well, that's some fanciful story from China or Tibet. God has the power to effectively do what God wants done. And if that's for me to die and you to live, or you to die and me to live, or all of us live for 100 years, and or all of us die, folks, it's God. That's the power. Don't worry about the power of Herod and the power of man. What's the worst they can do? Kill you. God says, I can do whatever I want with you. Well, I kind of wish the church had figured this one out, because we come to the third part, and that's the power of earnest prayer. The last part of verse 5, skip back there, unremitting prayer for him was made to God by the church. Now, skip ahead to verse 12, where we are in our story. When Peter realized that this was a miracle, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John Mark, where many were gathered together and praying. The church was praying. I love that word in verse 5, unremitting or unrelenting or continuous or persistent. I don't know what word you have in there. It's a medical term, ectemos, which means you stretch out muscles that are atrophied. You stretch out limbs that couldn't walk or couldn't hold or do anything. That's the kind of prayer, the prayer that just says, I don't have the strength. I don't know, but I'm going to stretch out to God and say, God, do a miracle. Peter is a gifted, great man of God. We need him. Your church needs him. And they were unremittingly praying for him. Herod and the soldiers had prisons. The church had prayer. And when every other gate is locked and the chains are tight, the door of heaven is open. Consciously coming to the realization, Peter, you know, he's now a block away from the prison, down a side street, thinking, okay, middle of the night, I'm an escaped prisoner. I'm going to go to where the Christians are. And he knew where the church where the Christians met. You remember, a little family history here. Mary and Barnabas were relatives. In the early church in Jerusalem, Barnabas sold his land, he sold his home, gave it to the needy, Acts chapter 4. You can read the story again if you need to. Mary had a big house, courtyard, big rooms. She didn't sell what she had. She kept it and allowed the church to meet there. So Peter knew what was happening. Okay, John Mark's mom, Mary, is over here at her house. There's going to be a bunch of Christians here. They're all going to be praying. And they've got servants. This is a great thing. And so he said, I'm going to go to Mary's house. John Mark became a friend with Peter. And eventually, by the way, he went with Peter. If you read 1 Peter 5, and the gospel of Mark is actually Peter's sermon that Mark, who traveled with him, wrote down. Peter's sermon on the life of Christ. It's phenomenal to think of. That's why Mark is kind of a short, choppy little story, because that's the way Peter preached. Hey, he was a fisherman. And John Mark had been with Barnabas and Saul on the first missionary journey, with Barnabas on the second, with Paul in prison. He came there to help. You know, this is a good family here. And they cared passionately about the things of God. And so Peter ended up at this house. He knew where to go in the dark. Verse 13, and when he knocked on the door at the gateway, there's a door outside, courtyard, then the inner area where the church is meeting quietly, secretly, fearful that the next knock on the door could be the secret police of Herod and arrest them all. A knock came. The disciples said, okay, somebody's out there knocking in the middle of the night. Let's send a little girl. They won't hurt a little girl. That's the brave Christians of their day. You've got to read this into the story and see the mindset that's here. And so they sent a little girl named Rhoda. By the way, that's the only girl mentioned by name in the Bible. Rhoda. Interesting little sidelight. But she came to answer. And what would you do? You don't know who's out there. Somebody's knocking on the door. It's the middle of the night. You're fearful it's the cops. And so Rhoda says, who is it? And Peter says, it's me, Peter. And Rhoda recognized Peter's voice. And in her joy, she didn't open the gate, but ran back inside and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. I think this is a cute story. you've all heard this story before, right? I mean, this gets preached. This is one of those children's type stories of this little faithful girl risking life and limb, and nobody else inside believes her. Nobody else is willing to go. It's kind of a tender and amusing incident that comes through all of this. So she is telling the believers inside that Peter is there joyfully announcing his arrival, that God has delivered him. And they said to her in verse 15, "You're out of your mind, kid." But she kept insisting it was so. And they kept saying, "It's his angel. It's a spirit. Looks like him. Sounds like him." But Peter kept knocking. And last time I heard, spirits and angels don't knock. They just open the doors and the chains and everything. And when they opened it, they saw him and were amazed. She was so excited, she left Peter out in the street where he could be arrested and seen by others. But the church people, fervently reaching out in prayer, "God, answer our prayer." And when God answers their prayer, they don't believe him. Now, does anyone have a testimony you'd like to share about that from your life? You know, we've been talking with Jim and Nancy Joe and my wife and I about what's going to happen in the future of our church. Because my health is not great, my age is greater yet. And what's going to happen? Well, you know, Jim said what we have to do is everybody has to pray. And I say, amen, but we have to pray believing that God's got an answer. Okay? We don't pray and say, "Lord, you've got to take care of this church. This is our family here, and Dr. Bob is old and feeble." Use any word you'd like at this point. Chime right in. Senile, warped, 1 foot in the grave, whatever you'd like. Going to Hawaii by my Magnum PI shirt that I'm wearing. Hey, I'm trying to continue summer one more week here, just as much as I can. When we pray, we had better believe. And not say, "Well, you know, God knows, I guess. We'll see how it all works out after the funeral," or whatever you're thinking right now. You know, this can't be Peter. Herod's probably already killed him. Must be his spirit. You pray and you don't believe God. And folks, I could share you illustrations of my life personally where I've done just that. Worried, prayed. I told the story of smuggling Bibles into the Soviet Union back in the 70s. Suitcase full of Bibles and New Testaments, covered over with a layer of clothes, and go through the lines coming in at the airport in Leningrad, St. Petersburg now. And every suitcase is opened ahead of me. And they open it and they stir and they look in there and they're looking for contraband. They pull out a Time magazine. Ooh, that's pornography. That's bad. Can't have that. And it gets to be my turn, and I keep letting everyone in line go ahead of me, hoping that there'll be a change of guard up there and the guys with the AK-47s. And as I get up there, a whole new group of tourists come in. There is a whole new group of guards and clerks at the customs counter there, and they're all waiting to speak German and with their new people, and I'm the last of the English-speaking guys. And they said, "What do you have to declare?" And I laid my suitcases up there and I'm about ready to throw up. That's the great faith of your pastor, okay? And I said, "Oh, I have a gold ring." And they go and look at it, and the gal's reading, she says, "Mara, what's that word?" And I said, "Maranatha. It means Jesus is coming." It's the name of my college, my seminary. I'm a minister. Go, oh, that's really something. And the other staff go up and say, get this guy out of here. You got a whole group behind him. And so she says, don't worry about your suitcase. Just go. And I pick up the suitcases and go out and hail a cab. Eat all the Tums that I had in my pocket. I was nervous, miserable. Oh, me of little faith. This is real life, folks. Verse 17, Peter motioned to them with his hand to to be silent. And he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of prison. He said, tell these to James. James is in the half-brother of Jesus, who is the pastor of the church there, not James, who is dead, and Peter knows that. Tell it to James and the brothers, and then he departed and went to a hidden location. This is almost the final mention of Peter. We're going to see him in a couple of verses in Acts 15 when the Christians meet there, and then he's gone. He's out of the picture. Paul takes over because the ministry to the Jews is finishing right here. The ministry to the Gentiles is just beginning. He doesn't want to jeopardize the church. Remember, he's the most infamous escapee from jail now. Hated by every Jew, hated by Herod. Everybody's hunting him, so he just went off into a little intentional solitary confinement. And then the understatement of the year comes in verse 18. It says, now at daylight, Peter's gone, church is there rejoicing, saying, God answered our prayer even when we didn't believe. It says, at daylight, there was no little disturbance among the soldiers. Now to me, that's just one of those smile at phrases. Yeah, I bet there was no little disturbance. You got one prisoner to watch, one person to take care of, and he's gone. After Herod searched for him, couldn't find him, he examined the sentries and ordered that they should be executed. That was the power of Herod, that if a prisoner escaped, you got the punishment that the prisoner was going to get. And remember, he was going to be executed that day. Well, a bunch of sentries were executed instead, figuring that the guards must have cooperated with Peter's escape. And so the death penalty was worked. Power of evil men, power of an effectual God, the power of earnest, not believing at all, but earnest prayer. And then finally, the power of eternal justice. It's after Passover. The only blood that Herod has now is some of his soldiers. Verse 19 concludes, Herod left Judea for Caesarea and spent some time there. He had moved. He wanted to be good with the Jews. He'd moved the capital from Caesarea up to Jerusalem. Now he said, okay, I'm going to move back to Caesarea, back to the Roman provincial capital. Now Herod was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. They came to him in one accord, and having persuaded Blastus, his chamberlain, they asked for peace because their country depended on Judea, the king's country, for food. Herod Agrippa the First, moving the seat of government, is down there, and evidently there was a trade imbalance with the people up the coast. And Tyre and Sidon refers to any of the seacoast above Mount Carmel, up in Galilee and up into what's Phoenicia or today Lebanon. That area, mountainous, not real good with crops. They needed food from Galilee. They needed the breadbasket to provide them with the grains and things that they needed. And they weren't given anything in return. And so evidently there's a little political intrigue going on here with this trade imbalance, and the crowd was motivated to please Herod, and so they're down there just fawning over him, saying, oh, help us, help us, help us. And on the appointed day, verse 21, Herod put on his royal robes, took his seat on the rostrum and delivered an oration to them, and the people shouted, "It's the voice of a god, not a man." Which, if you're looking for money from the government, that's probably not a bad thing to say. You know, no matter who the president is or whatever, you say nice things about him, because I'm going to get a free cell phone, or I'm going to get welfare, or I'm going to get out of jail free card, or whatever it might be. It's human nature to look for political deliverers. We still see that today. And Herod willingly played the part. Josephus, the historian, said that his garment was made completely of silver thread. And he entered the theater early in the morning, and when the silver of his garment was illuminated by the sun, it shone so brightly that people couldn't look at it. It reminds me of the outfit I just bought for my wife for $398 at Kohl's. It was just so beautiful, you know. I'm sure people won't be able to look at it. It's so good. I can't imagine silver thread among the gold. Okay. So resplendent, Josephus said, that it caused a horror to come over the crowd. Could not look intently on him, and cried out, "He's not a man, he's a god." Well, what happens with that sort of idolatry? The story concludes in verses 23 and 24. Immediately, an angel of the Lord struck him down because he didn't give God the glory. He was eaten by worms. And the Greek word actually uses the word tapeworm. They call it the dragon-headed worm, the worm that grows inside of you and looks like a little dragon head as it goes through and eats away at you. Thought you'd appreciate this. It's almost lunchtime. You need to learn these things. And breathed his last. You see, Herod enjoyed the situation. He enjoyed the glory. He enjoyed the big crowds, the glamorous clothes. I mean, he was a rock idol. Peter refused the worship of man. Paul and Barnabas would refuse in another couple chapters, over in chapter 14. They'll refuse worship. But Herod? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm not a man, I'm a god. And corrupted from the inside out. I like this. The angel struck Peter and woke him. The angel struck Herod with a tapeworm. And he died. It started in his belly and started to eat the internal organs. Terrible pain. Josephus says he died after 5 days of unrelenting pain sitting on the toilet. Isn't that a great epitaph? Let's write that on the tombstone. Herod viewed Peter as the enemy of God's people, of the Jews and the Gentiles, and God viewed Herod as the enemy. But, verse 24, the word of God increased and multiplied, because it's the word of God, not the words of man. Oh, he's a god, he's not a man. No, it's the word of God that makes the difference. He showed he was in charge. Herod fought against God. Herod killed a disciple, James. And God killed Herod. You see, there was nothing capable of stopping the expansion of the church. Not corruption, not contention, not conflict with Jews and Gentiles. Nothing. Nothing could control it. The Roman Empire couldn't bound it. The rest of Acts shows that the church just continued to grow into Asia Minor, then into Europe, and then to the uttermost part of the world. You see, fighting against God doesn't work. It's just that simple. That's the premise of this message. That's the premise of Acts 12. These little vignettes of Peter and his release and of Herod and his death, it's folly, it's foolishness to fight against God. Friedrich Nietzsche, great philosopher, said God is dead. Religion or Christianity is for weaklings. When I taught philosophy at the college here in town, I wrote on the board, God is dead, and then signed Nietzsche. And then halfway through class, I wrote, Nietzsche is dead, signed God. Sinclair Lewis won the Nobel Prize in Literature, writing about a alcoholic womanizing evangelist, Elmer Gantry, mocking Christianity. By the way, Sinclair Lewis was an alcoholic womanizing writer who died a drunk. Ernest Hemingway lived a wanton life of adventure and sin. A hero to people today, Ernest Hemingway. I'm in charge. And he took out a shotgun and blew out his own brains. You see, God will win. It's foolish to fight against him.